Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. I appreciate you showing up, so let's get on into it. So this is my show. I am the Gingerbread Man, which was a nickname christened to me by a dude named Waffles when I was a sophomore in high school. He smoked pot with me in children's parks, and we did general hoodlum tomfoolery. And I always liked the notion because I have always been called Ginger or Firecrotch or any of these fun nicknames we give to red-haired peoples. And it's never exactly been cruel, but sometimes, you know, I remember being in middle school and having girls come up to me and ask me if the hair matched the drapes or the drapes matched the hair or whatever. The drape matched the carpet. There we go. And I just remember being so embarrassed just because of the innuendo. But yet again, I don't think it was exactly cruel. So that's where I got my nickname. And I just kind of tried to roll with it. And so when I decided to make this show, coming up on almost 3 years ago now, and I was looking for the most archetypical presence that I could try to assume, a character of sorts, I looked back to my past and I found the Gingerbread Man. So that's why I call myself that. Not in real life. But here you're in the Gingerbread Man's domain. This is my cavern of mystical bullshit, and I love it. I have two main tenets that I try to hold close, and these are practice points for me because I'm no master, I'm no sage, I'm not even that smart. I just think that I have this intense interest in the world and in human perspective, and in a way, I've been very pessimistic and counter and anti-theory and so argumentative about so many things. And I'm very critical about societal organizations and whatnot. But at the end of the day, I am most inspired and most filled with awe by our species, by humanity. And so ever since I could remember being able to think, which was quite a while ago, I've had this intense interest in what other people think, in science, in empiricism, even though I didn't know what empiricism was when I was five. Empiricism is basically the act of using experience to apprehend reality and to be able to learn things. Measurement is empirical. Science is empirical. I mean, that's why Sherlock Holmes said, "It's empirical, Watson." But I think that this interest has really made me want to make something for myself in a way, which is part of the reason why I started this. But ideas are very important to me. And so I have wanted to build on ideas, and I've wanted to study all of the different web works of perspective throughout the thousands of years of human history to try to find some sort of way to have a meaning system for myself. And as mentioned, I feel this is a creative act, and that's one of the things that I would hopefully want to inspire other people to do for themselves. And I think that this act is viral, it's infectious. I think it spreads from one person to the next. And when you see somebody doing something they love or expressing their sense of meaning, when I see somebody do that, it is one of my favorite things in the world. And it impresses me immensely. You know? And so a lot of the reasons that I have wanted to become more creative in artistic pursuits, in drawing and writing, is because I read people that I admired, and I thought that I could do this too. So I was inspired by some of these figures and a lot of the people that I talk about, even though they're long dead in a lot of instances. These are some of the important figures that inspired me to be who I am and who I am continuing to build. And I think any person on this planet can do that for themselves. I think you can do that. And it might not have anything to do with my meaning system or any of these ideas that I find cool. You know, like, it might not have anything to do with me. It might have to do with a different podcast. It doesn't fucking matter. But if there's anything that you can drag from listening to this little show that you happen to find today, is that go out, look out, and make yourself. Every single choice is a new step towards you continuing to build on and amalgamate, like a planetoid in the beginning of our solar system, collecting dust slowly and turning into all the planets and all the asteroids and shit. You know, we're accruing experience. We are accruing time. And embedded in that time is a multiplicity of choice. And that's artistic. And there's a creative element to that. So go take that and go do something and go read something and go be inspired by somebody that you find cool. And maybe try to go do that for somebody else. Yeah. And the other one that I'm going to continue to hearken to, and I know I take a lot of time at the beginning of all these episodes to talk about these two things over and over again, and I know I say a lot of the same things the same times the same way, but I try to bend it differently every time because I'm thinking about these things constantly and I'm trying to learn different aspects of how I'm going to move forward, you know. And so the other thing that I find incredibly important in this world is love, and it starts with softness. Like the Tao said in the last episode, at the end of that one, we were reading chapter something about how softness is what allows trees to bend in the wind, you know, and a big part of that, especially with love and compassion, comes down to tone. And there's a lot of languages out there that are a lot more tonal than English, like to the point that it's incredibly hard for people with Western vernacular to learn how to say phonetically some of these things. But in my mother tongue of English, I think a lot of people tend to be tongue blind. And we hurt each other's feelings really easily by not paying attention to the tone we use. And I'm speaking about my key witness, me, right here. I'm pointing my finger back at myself because all too often in parenting, I find myself using a shortened, aggravated, terse tone with my boy, you know, and I think it happens a lot in relationships too, even though I haven't been in a relationship in a while, you know. It's still this thing, especially with the people who are closest to us, like mom and dad, sisters, brothers, family. The people we feel the most comfortable with, I think, are the people we are most tone blind to. So that's the aspect of love that I want to consider this week, is how we show others compassion and softness with how we talk to them. We can have an immense impact on somebody's day and show them how we feel. Like, tone is the real window to our soul, not the eyes. Tone is what allows people to really feel what we're trying to say to them. And that's the aspect of love and compassion, because that's something that we can put an input into constantly, is how we speak, you know, not just what we say. Yeah. And so I think I rambled on enough about all that. So today's substance I want to talk about, not the whole episode, but just for a little bit here, as like a just to whet your taste buds as we get into some of the other stuff, because then I want to go into talking about Lucretius, the Epicurean philosopher from Latin-speaking Italy in the 100-ish BC area, I believe. Don't quote me. I'm really shitty with dates. That's my worst one. But we're going to get into the ideas. And so before we get into that, which may or may not be a little bit denser, I want to consider a new plant that I have been investigating and experimenting with, and give you some of my insights on its pharmacology and its history and my subjective uses and some of the things I've learned about it. So today's plant substance thing is blue lotus. Lotus flowers have a cultural history in a lot of places. Most particular for me, I think of Indian gurus sitting in lotus position. The lotus flower has a lot of fucking petals, and the act of it unfurling into its floral essence is impeccably timed, and it's apparently really cool to watch. Not that I've seen a lotus bloom in front of me, but I bet you could find some sort of time-lapse video online. But they're really pretty flowers, and they have this effulgence in, like, mysticism and all these kind of things. And so a certain breed of lotus, now please don't judge me because this is a hard word, but I believe it's Nymphaea caeruleae, something like that. And you really got to look up pictures of these flowers because they really are very, very pretty. The first time that I ever purchased blue lotus was from the internet or this weird organic supply store that I have in the older section of town here. But more than 10 years ago, I was probably 18. And with the lotus flowers, you could smoke them or brew them into tea. They taste good. So pharmacologically speaking, the two compounds that you're most looking at here would be apomorphine or aporphine and nuciferine. Aporphine is, so it's a morphine derivative, but it has nothing to do with the opiate receptors, which is really curious. It's much more interactive with the dopamine neurotransmitter sites. So the first time I read about this substance online, and I was trying to look at thinking about how it was going to make me feel because I got an extract and I was trying a larger amount, and I really never sensed much of it in smaller dosages, even though you can. I was expecting it to be a stimulant, and so I took it in the morning before work, and then I got to work and I was just really, really, really tired. And it was a horrible decision, and I immediately regretted it. And so nuciferin is a hypnotic, and I assume this is the one that has more of the visual effects, because some people report achieving hallucinogenic states with blue lotus, especially at higher dosages. Not that I've done that. Maybe one day. I don't know if I want to. But the nuciferin, which I just love that name, and I think that harkens back to some sort of its Latinized nomenclature. So, subjectively speaking, I tried it in a lot of different spaces. I consumed approximately a gram of 10-by extract purchased from a reliable vendor, and that amounts to about 10 grams of raw product, which is quite a bit of flowers. It's like multiple bowls of blue lotus if you're going to try to smoke that. And I tried it in the morning, regretted it. I tried it in the daytime, regretted it. And then eventually I tried it towards the evening and found that I had wonderful sleep with it, which I think is its biggest asset as an ally to us, is for its sleeping potential. And the dreams that I would have towards the end of the night, towards waking after taking blue lotus, were intriguing. And the more and more I try to delve into finding some way to attend and be able to remember my dreams, the harder it gets sometimes. But I do feel like I'm making leaps and bounds and I'm discovering something within myself. So that's your little foray on a plant this week. So maybe go look around. Blue lotus seems to be legal in a lot of places. I don't think it's illegal in any place specifically. It's starting to show up alongside these chocolate bars that we discussed the other week in the head shops. There's a lot more of these blue lotus extracts in vapes. Like you can vaporize it, and it's mixed with Delta 8, and it's mixed with Amanita extract. And so it's another one of those products that's hitting the head shop scenes, even though I would encourage heavily towards finding out whether any of the claims made by any of these products are accurate. You know, do your research always. I use a ethnobotanical vendor for my plant substances, and so I usually have a degree of trust in what I'm getting, and I don't buy them from head shops. But still, you might start to see a lot more of these products creep up as recreational use of a lot of these plants becomes more mainstream amongst our society. So now you know a little bit more about what Blue Lotus is, and whether or not you want to investigate more and do your own research. There's a lot of information online. You can listen to people talk about it. And yet again, cool stuff. I find it intriguing, these things that are becoming bigger and bigger in our society, when I feel like this was a lot more niche and a lot more unheard of, even though these things are hundreds and thousands of years old in cultural use and history. So the more you know. All right, so I want to return to Lucretius, which we talked about. It was Epicurean atomism, which I found very intriguing, which is just a quick recap, is the idea that all of the world is mechanical fundamentally, and that if we reduce things and split apart pieces, we can get to initial building blocks, which the ancient Greeks called atomos, which we use now in the word atom. So it's like these Newtonian idea of little tiny billiard balls colliding and reacting and, you know, interacting with each other, which is still a major part of many systemic models that we use to picture these quantum worlds, which may or may not be a picture of reality according to some of the new quantum math, which we also discussed a couple weeks ago. So that's kind of what I gave you about Epicurean philosophy. So now I want to tell you about some other things that I've been reading about from the book written by Lucretius, which was a poem, truthfully, which was this attempt to make prose so that it could be more digestible, which is brilliant. You want to encapsulate these great ideas in soft honey so that they're palatable and able to be ingested. And so I want to talk about some of his natural philosophy, which natural philosophy is the precursor to science, and it's where you get some of the original uses of the scientific method before it was coined into concretism in the Western world. You know, but before that, we had natural philosophers, which is people who philosophized about the natural world. And before we do that, I have to fact check myself, because I called Epicureans atheists, which is not true. I learned more once I read more. It tends to happen. And so one of the things I learned about Lucretius, at least in his Epicureanism, and I assume probably with the Epicureans themselves, was they weren't exactly atheists specifically. They still recognized the pantheon of gods or this otherly world where higher beings could exist. They just denied their impact in any way, shape, or form. So the Epicurean gods were like how I picture the United States government. They're like these people in this mystical space out there, but they don't really do anything. They're not affecting my life in any way, shape, or form. No matter what laws these people write or do whatever they do, I've still always done what I do, you know, and I've always had the degree of possible societal fallback or guilt that would happen if I fucked up too bad living in this world. But not at any point in time has the president come into my house and made a physical attack on me or, you know, took away my water. But there were people of religious bent probably all throughout human history, but especially I'm guessing towards this part of human history when you have these pantheonic gods, these angry Zeuses, and you have Homer writing about these highly personable, vengeful, judgmental, very anthropomorphized. These gods were very human, and they came down and had children with humans, you know, and beget demigods, you know. So there's this fear that all these gods are imminently present and impacting the world, you know. And Epicurus seemed to deny that. And the gods still exist out there, you know. And this kind of reminds me of Hinduism too, because there's a world of the gods that you could be born into in Hinduism, you know, but it's a different place. It's like a different fucking world. Like, they didn't build this place. Like, there's a bigger god, Brahma, you know, there's like this intelligence that's building the universe for the gods too. And I find that so compelling. So I was wrong, you know. So basically, the Epicurean gods are powerless. They didn't build anything, you know, like, if anything, the best thing they are to humans is an example, because they're always peaceful and placid, because these gods don't have human qualms or pursuits. They're not part of a world where everything has to eat each other and be reborn. You know, like, they're an example of what humans could be, because there's this essence of divinity that humans could have. And that's really cool. I like that. Lucretius expounds on it much more in a large portion of his book. It's a big part of his philosophy. All right. So, first thing that Lucretius discussed in his book concerning natural philosophy that I found of interest is a discussion of lightning. So, first off, clouds. So, I guess first off, actually, backslash a little bit forward back. So, the natural philosophy of these atoms, all these little tiny atoms, but not all atoms are the same. It's not like there's this fundamental atom. There's fire atoms and water atoms and air atoms. And then the air atoms get moving, and then they turn into wind. And he has all these examples, like, you know, like, talk about storms. You know, you can't see the wind, but it has a lot of force and impact. And he's like, that means that there has to be unseen atoms of air that are impacting the world. Cool. Love it. So the water atoms amalgamate in the air, and there's different types of water atoms. Certain are smoother and certain are softer, and they entangle, and all of a sudden you have these fucking clouds that start forming. Cool. Kind of like, it's very like awesome how much you see where a lot of these thoughts are really, 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 really old. So once you have these gigantic clouds, they become hollow, and then the wind has this immense power, and embedded in all the world is atoms of fire. And when things move, they get hot, which isn't always true, but when things spin really fast, they get hot, according to Epicurus. So if you have a lot of these spinning wind atoms trapped inside of a hollow space where the water is acting like a wall, they're bouncing around, colliding, they're causing friction. And so the fire heats up on the inside of the cloud, and the winds rage around, they freak out and get madder and madder. And all of a sudden, they bust out of the fucking cloud. And then the heat and all the fire that's been, like, basically, like, fucking getting more and more compressed against the side of the cloud, according to Lucretius, would burst out of the cloud in a pure form of heat and fire and the lightning bolt. However, this did not cause the thunder, according to Lucretius, which... I love how far off, like, how close some of their thoughts are, and then how just sublimely far off some of it is, too. This is probably because there was a lack of knowledge about the speed of sound and how big things were in reality. Because of perspective, it's hard to know how big these clouds were. But he pictured the clouds as being a lot more solid than they actually are. And so as the clouds rumble and go past each other, certain clouds are entities, and they would crash against each other and cause the thunder. But there wasn't this connection between the lightning and the plasma itself and the burning of the air, even though there is this mention of things being cauterized and metal being melted. It's just so cool reading some of these examples and seeing this mind, and this work is truly potent if you look at it in its context, especially. And it makes you think about how smart these people were and how they were not idiots. They were not dummies. Like, humans have been intelligent and wise as long as we've been humans. and we amalgamate, we grow. And now, sitting here in 2024, we're sitting on the shoulders of every single human that's lived before us, so we're carrying their knowledge too. And so that's why we see this sense of superiority, you know. But the basicness, the basic building blocks of wisdom, they equally have what we have. They have the same potential. You know, we just happen to have been born 2,000 years later. So the next bit of physical wonder that he discusses is this idea called a prester. So this is really cool. Presters are water spouts. So the Greeks were mariners. They were masters of the Mediterranean. So they spent a lot of time on these boats. And because of this, they had an intense knowledge of navigation and how to look. And so we assume that being on these ships, they're spending a lot of time observing their surroundings. And in their surroundings are these water spouts. I don't know if you've seen a video of one or seen one in person. I've seen one in person in Florida. They're fucking cool. And I saw a video of this dude in a boat trying to approach one, and it was not the biggest water spout. Some water spouts can be hundreds of meters wide, like fucking water tornadoes. But this one in the video was like maybe 3 or 4 feet. Still could have fucking killed him, but still. So these presters, he talks about how the winds all across the world like get a lot of potency and they get strong and they're like all in this big ass river of wind, and then they get trapped inside the clouds, and sometimes they'll have so much force as they flow into the cloud that they just get diverged and they just punch their way through the bottom into the ocean. But he talks about people in ships getting trashed by the maelstroms. He talks about the masses of water being ruffled up, and so it's, you could see that the closeness and how scary this is. And he's talking about it in a scientific way. There's no gods or anything, you know. And of course the science is bullshit, you know. There's no such thing as, that's not how wind works. If it's the spinning and the convection and all of the force of the motion and the wind, you know, but it's not all just the simplicity of his air, water, fire, fucking elemental system that he's got going on with his atomics. But it's still cool. I find it so interesting. The last thing that I want to discuss today from Lucretius was the earthquakes. So he pictured the earth as having an underneath, because they talk about how the sun and the moon disappear, so obviously they have to go under. You know, and he even talks about the sun reflecting the light, or not the sun reflecting light, the moon reflecting light of the sun. There we go, got it right. Yeah. But all these observations lead to what sounds like a geocentric round earth system, which of course gets supplanted by Copernicus when we start to use the heliocentric model, and there was other philosophers. But these Epicureans, even though they had an empirical mindset that was not very imaginative, they also didn't do a lot of intense math or actual like hardcore analysis like other Greeks did, such as Aristotle or Pythagoras. You know, the Epicureans were not doing a lot of calculations. They were hedonists. You know, they were seeking the ultimate pleasure. And so they were not spending a lot of time philosophizing as much as others, you know. And it's cool because you start to see into the background themes of what the belief systems were of these people over 2,000 years ago. So for him, the earth is hollow. Oops. The earth is hollow, like huge caverns, hollow earth theory, full blown. And inside these gigantic hollow caves are intense winds that punch their way out sometimes and make volcanoes, or sometimes they'll push really hard against the cave wall, so the cave wall will bend and flex and it'll move everything on top of it, and then it'll recoil, which is what happens for some earthquakes. And sometimes the piece of earth will just give way and fall into another gigantic cavern deep inside the earth, and you'll have a slip and a giant crack will form, you know. No speak of magma oceans like we see now in our tectonic models ever since the dude with whose name started with W set up the whole plate shifting theories, you know, and that is so endemically part of the belief systems in our world that it's hard for me to picture, like, his idea of just big ass hollow caves fracturing the entire planet, you know, is really far out for me to try to comprehend. But when I step away for a little bit and I look at what they had at their powers of observation, you know, in order for W guy to figure out about plate drift and continental drift, you know, and he was the dude who thought about Pangaea too, you know, a lot of those theories were based on observations of mid-Atlantic trenches and looking at how you could look at basaltic rock and see how the alterations in magnetic, like, alignment in the iron, you could date the rock and figure out how much rock had been laid in a certain amount of time. You could see how far continents were moving. And this was a major part of the theory. And I doubt ancient peoples were observing the same things that we were, if that makes any sense. There's just a difference in what was available to apprehend. And of course, that harkens back to what is the importance of observation and how much impact we have on what we know and by what we look at. And I don't know. I find it so interesting and so compelling. And so thank you for letting me share that with you, because I just thought that would be fun. And I think that's about it. I think that's about my yarn. I'm going to give you a little bit of Lucretius, probably. I'm going to read a little bit of him, just since we're just talking about him. And we'll see if Odin wants to talk. He's been not very pro-talking lately, so he might not want to. But we'll see. He's been a great guy. He's been working really, really, really hard at day camp, and he's been treating people better. And I'm very proud of my little boy for stepping up and being a good man. All right, I'll be right back. I'm on book 6 of The Nature of Things, which this is the translation by Frank Copley of Lucretius. And this is talking about rain and cloud formation and I think a little bit of lightning, perhaps. I don't remember exactly where we were, but here goes. Now here, how water droplets high in the clouds gather and grow into rain, are freed and fall to earth. I'll explain. And first, I'll prove that many atoms of water at once rise to the clouds from everything, and the two increase alike, the clouds, that is, and the water that's in the clouds. As in us, flesh and blood increase alike, sweat too, and other such humors in our body. Besides, they often pick up lots of moisture out of the sea, like hung out hunks of wool, when the clouds are carried by winds above the ocean. In similar wise, from every river, moisture is borne to the clouds. When atoms of water there have gathered and grown by thousands from every source, the clouds enlarged are doubly driven to a drop their moisture, for winds press hard, and as the clouds pile higher and higher and start to churn, they cause downward pressure, which forces rain to fall. Besides, when clouds are thinned out, too, by winds, or hammered to bits by heat of the sun above, they drop their moisture and drip with rain, as wax over hot fire melts to a liquid puddle. But wild rains fall when clouds piled high are wildly crushed by both heat and water and driving wind. But rains have often gone on for days and lasted long, when seeds of water race in by thousands when saturated clouds, one on another, gather in high-piled masses from every zone, and all the earth exhales a steamy breath. Then, when the storm is darkest and the sun shines with his rays across the dripping rack, a painted bow stands out against black clouds. All else that grows up there created, and all that grows along with clouds, yes, all, from start to finish, snow, wind, hail, cold, frost, ice, mighty forces, great hardeners of water, durance that commonly curbs our eager streams, it's eager to search them out and see in mind how they all happen and why they come to be, once you have learned what powers the atoms have. Come now and learn what causes set the earth to quaking. First, you realize that the earth under as well as over is largely filled with windy caves. I'm going to stop there. All right. So, yeah, there's an example of what I was trying to discuss, and I hope you enjoyed it. So, as always, thank you so much for your time this evening, morning, whenever you've decided to listen. I'm here for you. My primary reason for making this is not to hear myself speak. I want to give you something that you could use to go forward in your world and make something beautiful. And that beautiful thing is your life. You can impact everybody around you to live a more fulfilling life through your own act. And I think you can do it, no matter what it is. So, signing off, the Gingerbread Man.
What's up? It's the Asco and the Gingerbread Man.
Woo!
So, how you been doing?
I'm all right.
I think you guys been doing good.
How are you?
Good.
Cool.
So. It's been a long time.
You say that every time. It's always been like a week or two. That's it.
I know, but it just feels like a long kid.
How's your summer going?
Good.
These are doing really, really good. I was just telling them that. You want to talk about how good you're doing?
Sure. How good is your summer?
Good job.
I'm just... Hey. What? I got a joke for you.
What's your joke?
What do you call a box is boxing?
What is a box that is boxing?
A pox clockerero.
A pox clockerero.
I don't even think that makes sense.
I thought it was great. I loved it. That was good.
Okay.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.